It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, what are you afraid of?
I was at home, and I was living alone at the time, and I heard what to me sounded like someone trying to break into my house. And I hid and called my boyfriend. And when he got there, you know, he did a perimeter of my house and was like, it was like the trash can blowing over. You are in possessing of a wildly overactive imagination. But what was it you were so afraid of? And I really don't remember what I told him, but I do remember the image that popped into my head. It was the image of this tall, lanky, young black man.
Fear of black men. That's the issue today, isn't it? The ugly truth hiding behind the deaths of Michael Brown, Eric Garner, and so many more. We don't like to admit it, but a lot of Americans are afraid of black men. So what happens when you recognize that fear in yourself? When Rachel Shadone realized she was biased against young black men, actually afraid of them, she was appalled, and she decided to do something about it. She tells her story in a recent article titled, I Am Racist, and So Are You.
I mean, you do feel bad. It's made me a lot more conscious of the way I carry myself around black male strangers. Like, it's very important to me that I don't let any of my conscious or unconscious racial bias ruin their day.
So as you began to notice and name your own internalized bias and your own fear reactions, where do you think they came from in you? I mean, did you grow up around many people of color?
You know, I didn't grow up around very many people of color. It wasn't until I was in high school that I had very much exposure to people of color at all. And neighborhoods are pretty segregated still mm-hmm. in a lot of the country. So if you go to a neighborhood school, you're likely to be around people of your sort of same social economic class and as well as your own race.
So I'm curious, once you began noticing these things in yourself and kind of naming them, did that begin to change any of your interactions with African Americans?
I don't know if it changed my interactions, but it definitely changed the way I think. So there is a check now in my brain that is, I have a thought, particularly if it's about a person or about a way someone is acting. Why am I thinking that? And that's sort of the crucial step.
So you sounds like you've learned to watch yourself, to watch your own interactions.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what, you know, good teachers have been trying to teach us since like preschool, right? Think before you speak. Think before you act. And so just building in that layer of metacognition, why am I thinking that?
Have you talked about this with African-American friends and especially male African-American friends? And have they, I'm curious about what their reaction is.
You know, many of my black friends are like, you know, this really, you get it. This is, you get it. And that's good, but I'm not looking for absolution. In part because, I mean, this is obviously, this is not good. This is a cognitive bias. This is something that hurts people. This ruins people's lives. Racism is a system in which we all participate. Like, it's not just, you know, easily pointed out racist actions. Like, you know, that was a racist thing that happened. It's a lot of, like, micro judgments, things that happen so quickly that we may not even notice them.
I mean, going back to you personally and your own experience, you know, you've worked hard, it sounds like, to unpack and look at your own internalized bias. What happens now when, say, you pass a young black man on the street?
Well, as I said, like, I do spend a fair amount of time, like, how do I not ruin this poor kid's day? But mostly it's something that I pray no one can read on my face. You know, it's very, I am sometimes still nervous, particularly like in situations where I expect it to be alone. But it's not, It was never like I'm quaking in my boots in terror. It was always a very subtle, I am more nervous in this situation than I would have been if you were, you know, a white dude. And so I just try to behave as a person and interact with that person as an individual instead of a symbol of their race.
Rachel Shadone's article is called I Am Racist, and So Are You. You can find it on our website at ttbook.org. At the heart of Americans' fear of black men is an ugly stereotype, the black criminal. It's a toxic and remarkably persistent stereotype, but where did it come from? Historian Khalil Gibran Muhammad traces some of our current attitudes about race and crime back to the late 19th century, when early sociologists first began looking at crime statistics. He tells Steve Paulson how the archetype of the black criminal emerged after slavery.
So you've got 4 million people who had, in a historical blink of the eye, gone from being enslaved to free. And the question was, how do they fit? What are they capable of? What is the quality of their contribution to society? And it just so happened this was a moment for the emergence of what we think of as sociology today, or more generally, the social sciences. So there was a lot of focus on demographics and health and mortality rates and essentially ranking various groups, largely European immigrants, like African Americans, into categories of fitness, what kinds of contributions would they make. So that was the larger context in which this question of criminality emerged.
So there were crime statistics that were used to promote this idea of black criminality.
Yes, but more particularly, it wasn't obvious that that would be the signpost for black people's fitness in modern life. A couple of innovative demographers noted that African Americans were disproportionately represented in the nation's prisons one generation after slavery. The number was roughly 30% of 82,000. And that number represented a nearly 3 times overrepresentation of African Americans, who were only 12% of the general population.
It sounds like a very familiar story today.
It is a very familiar story. And what's interesting about it is, while we know what that means to a lot of people, back then, someone had to explain it. Someone had to make meaning of it. And it was in that origins moment, the use of crime statistics in the U.S. Census, one generation after slavery, particularly the 1890 Census, did we set in motion a set of ideas that are in circulation today and essentially justify certain forms of discriminatory treatment, both explicitly within our criminal justice systems as well as in general society.
Well, you write about this association between blackness and criminality as, to some degree, the work of a demographer named Frederick Hoffman. Why was he so significant?
He's really the first person to make a big deal about this. He's the first person to look at the U.S. Census data in 1890, see the disproportionate rates of African Americans in prisons at that time, and write about it in such a way that others took note, and he started a trend. And that trend essentially said that in the aftermath of slavery, crime statistics among African Americans prove that they are, one, inferior, two, retreating or reverting to an ancestral state closer to savagery than to citizens, and should be subjected to different standards of justice as a result.
So he had a whole, he didn't just talk about the statistics, he had this whole racist interpretation of them.
Well, it would be easy to call it racist today, because then we could dismiss him to the dustbin of history. He was actually incredibly innovative. What made him innovative and what made his arguments stick and be so transformative and significant even to this day was that he made the argument using what we would recognize today as a kind of post-racial logic. He made the case that the crime statistics were actually race-neutral or colorblind. Hoffman said, well, the statistics literally speak for themselves. We can just see, what do they do when given a chance to participate in society? Oh, they turn out to be a bunch of criminals.
So how should those crime statistics have been used, have been interpreted? I mean, if sociologists really knew what they were doing.
Looking back, we could say that it turns out a significant number of African Americans were subject to new forms of racial surveillance and social control. In other words, that 30% number would have a gigantic asterisk or footnote attached to it saying, we have no idea how much racism there was in the 1870s and 80s that produced this number, but we know it was a whole lot. Therefore, this number can't be taken at face value. The other thing that actually happened in that moment was you had significant rates of homicide, crimes of poverty and property, underground participation in drug markets by European immigrant groups, largely Italians, Irish, Polish, Catholics. Their crime statistics were through the roof in many cities, and people we come to know as progressives, those who were essentially liberals, arguing that inequality was the basis for social disorder in the nation's leading cities at the time, explained the crime statistics.
So the difference there was black people were considered as sort of innately violent, whereas there were kind of environmental reasons why these white immigrants committed crimes.
That's right. The footnote, there was a gigantic footnote attached to the European immigrants' crime and none attached to African Americans. One spoke for itself. The other one had a very long explanation.
Now, there were critics back then of Hoffman's work. W.E.B. Du Bois was a big critic of his research, wasn't he?
Du Bois was the first African-American to really gain status as a national expert on the black urban condition and race in general. He actually writes in an 1898 article on the study of the American Negro a response to Hoffman's work, because he sees it as incredibly dangerous. He describes Hoffman as essentially doing drive-by sociology, that no foreigner can simply look at census data and put his finger on the pulse of a problem. Hoffman was a German immigrant who arrived in the United States in 1884.
Of course, the other side of this whole discussion of criminality is how it plays out in law enforcement and policing, a subject that is on everyone's mind these days. Are there parallels to what was going on back then?
It would be impossible not to find a moment if you read the daily newspapers of Philadelphia, of Chicago, of New York, of Cleveland and Detroit, and not see stories that sound identical to the problem of stop and frisk today, or even the idea of broken windows, that is, policing low-level status offenses. When black people stepped outside of the prescribed areas, they were subjected to forms of heavy-handed, often brutal policing that sent a message that you are out of place, you are not welcome here. So the form of policing that evolved in the North evolved not only in direct relationship to these ideas articulated through crime statistics, but also through the way in which the city itself evolved in the North, which was very different than what segregation looked like in the South.
So the kinds of questions about inequality that we're dealing with today, racial profiling, sort of differences in the length of sentencing, were those talked about back then as well?
Only to a degree, and it took time. So by the late 1920s, the work of people like Du Bois or Ida B. Wells, people like that helped to reshape the debate among American criminologists, white criminologists like Edwin Sutherland and Thorsten Sellin, who were two of the leading criminologists of the period. They were swayed by the arguments of their black counterparts, and they too noted excessive police activity in the black community amongst innocent people. They noted disproportionate sentencing of African Americans for crimes that whites similarly engaged in, and began to call crime statistics a legal fiction or evidence of the legal fictions of equality. That was a significant breakthrough in the late 1920s and early 1930s.
So you're saying that there were critics of the criminal justice system, of policing procedures, of African Americans being targeted going back at least a century, which does raise the question, why hasn't there been more progress since then?
Well, sometimes beliefs trump data, meaning that it didn't matter that you had counter evidence. Can I give you a really good example?
Sure.
In the 1922 report of the Negro in Chicago, it was one of the first Blue Ribbon commissions to study the outcome of a race riot. What they found was not only that there was so much racism in the criminal justice system that crime statistics were essentially useless, but they also had direct testimony from judges, from police officers, from district attorneys, all whites, saying that when we come across African-American suspects, we treat them differently because we are afraid that if we don't control them, we'll lose track of them. In other words, we keep a close eye on them and we don't give them the benefit of the doubt. So this was a major admission within a major sociological report on a major riot in a major city, Chicago, over 100 years ago, and it made very little long-term difference.
So let's bring this story up to the present now. You know, huge national debate about all of these issues that we've been talking about. Is there something new going on right now, or are we just replaying the story that you've been describing that goes back at least 100 years?
It's a little bit of both. So on one hand, there is a long tradition of fighting racial violence, if we think of it in the broadest sense, whether it's by an individual citizen or by a police officer. What we did not see, however, was that the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s did not make attacking racism in the criminal justice system as a core pillar of its work, which is to say what we are potentially seeing is the first national movement directed explicitly to the criminal justice system as a civil rights movement, not about racial violence, but about criminal justice.
Now, we've been talking about this really depressing history, frankly, of, you know, how a lot of these problems we're very aware of today go way back, and people talked about them back then. It does raise the question of what can we do?
Well, we start telling a different story of who we are as a nation. We've never really come to terms with our racial legacy. We treat it as an aberration. But the truth is that America can't be America without having had slavery. So these are things that your listeners are already saying, what does that have to do with changing the circumstances of today? But that's precisely the point. We have a deep aversion to a full reckoning with our history. And it doesn't have to make us feel bad, but it is the necessary precondition for holding ourselves accountable when we do slide into the past from the present and start to see things that are far too eerily familiar. So education and how we teach matters greatly to this.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad is the director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture at the New York Public Library. He's also the author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. I'm Anne Strange-Shamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This hour, we've been talking about racial fear, especially white America's fear of African-American men. But what are African-American men afraid of?
My biggest fear is my father was killed when I was a very young age, maybe about 2-3 years old, through violence, through gun violence. And my biggest fear is that I will lose my wife, my kid, my son or my daughter through some violent way like that. That's the biggest fear to me, especially my son. That's a fear, and also fear that I won't be around for him. I know what it is to grow up without a father, and my greatest fear is not being there for my wife and my kids, because I can understand what my mom went through and what me and my brothers and sisters went through being raised without a father. So that's my biggest fear.
I fear success. I fear success because I don't even know. I have all of these things pulling me to which way success really is. I got a whole bunch of people trying to tell me what their reality of success is. I'm scared to follow my heart. That's what I'm scared of.
I've had all kinds of physical challenges throughout my life that I've overcome. I've had all kinds of racist challenges that I've dealt with head on. Nothing scares me. And I think that comes from the way I was raised. I've had life-threatening illnesses that I've overcome. Nothing scares me anymore.
I am scared for the future of our people in this country. When I look at the alarming rates of incarceration amongst our men, when I look at the health crisis within our community, I am alarmed. And I am, scared is not the word, but I am very concerned and apprehensive about our future. You know, hopefully these ideas will change, but when I look at these ever-growing statistics, it pains me to see what type of future we're gonna have. When I look at the escalation of violence within our community, it hurts me. So I really wonder about the future.
Those are just a few of the voices from a transmedia project called Question Bridge, Black Males. It was created by Chris Johnson and Hank Willis Thomas with Bayate Ross Smith and Kamal Sinclair. And this was just a small sampling from the project. If you'd like to hear more, visit our website at ttbook.org. The video of the death of Eric Garner, that footage of him lying on the ground, gasping, "I can't breathe," that was so upsetting, so deeply painful for many of us. And it's raised all sorts of questions. Questions about police strategies, use of force, racism. Writer Emily Bazelon has been asking herself an ethical question. When do you call the cops on a black man?
Like a lot of people, I've been thinking about race and the cops lately. Writing about legal issues for 20 years has taught me that black people really are at risk from the police in a way that the rest of us are not. Maybe the unfairness I'm talking about is obvious to you, whatever your race. There's plenty of evidence that black men bear the brunt of arrests, convictions, and long sentences in America. Just do a little research on police stop and frisk practices or racial disparities in sentencing, and it's plain to see how the police and the justice system come down harder on black men. As a journalist covering the law, it's pretty much a given for me that if the criminal justice system gets a hold of a black person, especially if he's poor, there's a serious heightened risk that it will crush him. Okay, yes, I know we need law enforcement. I know most cops are good people trying to do a difficult job as well as they can. But the police have so much power. And often, they're not held accountable for abusing the power they have, even when it seems as if they broke their own rules, like when a New York police officer killed Eric Garner in a chokehold. All of these factors mean that far too many black people die from cops' bullets. One new analysis shows that black males are 21 times more likely than white males to be shot and killed by the police. Let me say that again, 21 times more likely to be shot and killed. That even includes kids, like Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old boy who was shot by a Cleveland cop, who responded to a report that Tamir held a gun on a playground. The gun turned out to be a toy. In fact, the person who called 911 about Tamir said the gun was fake. But the dispatcher didn't pass along that information, and the cop had a record for emotional immaturity and poor communication. And within 2 seconds of the police cruiser pulling into the playground, Tamir had been shot. So in the wake of all of these stories, I've also been thinking about how, as a white person, my own actions have been shaped by law enforcement's treatment of Black people. These days, if I have a choice about whether to involve the police in the life of a Black person, I will try to choose not to. Of course, if anyone of any race breaks into my house or threatens my kids, I'll call 911 and pray as hard as I can for the police to come. But much of the time, our choices are made in hazier gray areas. Think about the story of Deborah Harrell, a single mom with a job at McDonald's, who let her daughter spend a few days of summer vacation playing alone in the park. Someone called the cops, and Harrell was arrested. Her daughter was sent to foster care. If I saw a 9-year-old Black girl alone in the park, and she said her mother was at work, I would not call the police. I would ask the girl if she was okay and try to talk to her mom. Because the truth is, in this country right now, once the wheels of the bureaucratic state start to turn, they can grind people up. Maybe the police want to help, but they don't have discretion. Maybe the law just isn't written the right way. Whatever the cause, I'd rather avoid bringing its weight to bear on someone else, especially when I know that person is less likely to get a fair shake. Black people need the protection of the police just like everyone else. Sometimes they call out for a stronger police presence. But too often, the arm of the government that is meant to help them hurts them instead. Maybe we should all keep that in mind when we consider calling the cops.
Emily Bazelon is a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine. This essay was adapted from a Slate article. If you want to read it, go to ttbook.org. In the 1980s and 90s, civil rights attorney Connie Rice was on a roll. Her class action lawsuits won more than $10 billion in damages in the LA area, but more and more police brutality cases were coming across her desk. And then on March 3, 1991, a video of Rodney King being beaten by LAPD officers shook the nation. And Connie Rice declared war on the LAPD.
All we were asking for was, please don't humiliate us. Please don't pull us over for no reason. Please don't beat us up for no reason. And LAPD was so brutal and so gang-like back in those days that they couldn't stop themselves from doing all of those things over and over and over again in the Black community, mainly in the Black community.
Connie Rice won major lawsuits against the LAPD, but still, police brutality was intensifying. She says at one point, she even got a death threat from within the LAPD. So fast forward to today, and it's kind of astonishing that Connie Rice now works with the LAPD. She's currently training and supervising 50 police officers in one of the city's toughest communities. Charles Monroe Kane sat down with her to find out more.
How do you change how cops think? Do you just sit down with cops and sit in their car with them and retrain them? That sounds so unrealistic to me.
Right. Well, first of all, you talk to them about the thresholds. Why are you pulling anybody over? Is it just because you saw somebody Black in an expensive car that you didn't think they ought to be driving? Or did they really break a rule that needed to be enforced? So it's the threshold for pulling somebody over, the grounds for pulling somebody over. Then once you've pulled them over, the attitudes with which you address them, how polite you are or impolite. I mean, they used to just speak to people in an awful tone. It was disrespectful. It was full of derision. It was very clear they were out to humiliate people. They would pull people out of their cars and throw them on the ground and prone them out for no reason. Jeez. They didn't care if you were in a business suit or in jeans. They would prone people out for absolutely no reason. There's no reason to prone anybody out unless you're about to make an arrest. They weren't going to arrest these people. They just wanted to humiliate them. So you go over every single moment of the encounter with the public and you dissect it. And then you make them go through some practice sessions with how they're going to change their behavior. And yeah, you have to model it. You have to analyze it for them. You have to identify the problem. You have to analyze how you pick it apart and understand what they're doing currently. Then you have to show them what you want them to move to. It's painstaking and it's painful, but that's what it takes to re-engineer and reprogram your cop behavior.
At one point, I think it was in an 18-month period, you interviewed personally, one-on-one, over 900 police officers. What do they say?
They really opened up. They just did a download of all their thoughts and all their fears. And I would hear things like, look, lady, I'm going to be honest with you. Black people scare me. I didn't grow up around black people. I grew up in Antelope Valley. We didn't have any blacks. And I don't really know how to talk to them. Or, lady, black men scare me. And I need help. I mean, I was stunned. Wow. I had to kind of keep the stunned look off of my face, and I could not be judgmental. I had to sit there and listen, and then I had to offer something helpful that told them, look, it's part of the human condition to be afraid of people you're not familiar with. It's also part of the human condition to be wary of people you've never been around. So just accept that as the human condition, and let's move on from there. Now, here are some of the coping skills. Do you want to know how you break down the fear? Well, you hang around with folks. You get to know them. You know, once you know somebody by their first name, even if it's Pookie, and even if Pookie is a gang member, you know what? Once you sit down and talk to Pookie, once you have breakfast with him every now and then, once you start hanging out with him and play basketball a couple of times a week with him, guess what? You're going to become really relaxed around him, and you're not going to fear him anymore. Because really, while Pookie's a gang member, he's not really one of the bad guys. Hmm. And you can begin to make those distinctions. And surely and slowly, that's how we did it.
Did you think they were cognizant of the fact that their fear was creating a lot of the violence that was happening in L.A. from police to black men?
No, I don't think they connected those dots. I think what they realized was that the level of discomfort with blacks meant they had to fix that because they knew they weren't interacting with people in a proper way. They knew that much. They felt so uncomfortable that they actually voiced that fear. And it was enough to voice that fear. And I said, well, that's what's driving your discomfort. And your discomfort is leading to misunderstandings. And the misunderstandings lead to friction, and the friction leads to problems. So they got that much. But I don't think that they connected the dots quite the way you and I would.
But you say you were surprised, almost shocked, at how many times these men talked about being afraid of black men. Were you ready to, I mean, did you know that was the issue before you went into it? Or are you really surprised that fear was such a big issue?
I didn't think that fear would be as big of an issue. I knew that unfamiliarity was an issue. I mean, I'm just talking basic familiarity so that you don't startle when a black man walks in the room. Or you don't get that heightened heartbeat whenever you see black men.
So Charlie Beck, the LAPD chief, put you in charge of 50 officers to train them, to supervise them. How did you integrate these ideas into their daily job?
Well, we start by saying you're not going to get promoted for how many arrests you make, which is a shock to cops because that's how most cops are promoted. I told these cops, you are not in the arrest business. You are a specialized unit that is in the trust building business. And those cops looked at me like I had really lost my wig.
I bet they thought,
when I told them you are not going to get promoted based on the number of arrests, their eyes got big. I said, in fact, if you make any arrests for minor infractions, including drug infractions that don't harm anybody else and involve no violence, you're going to get dinged for that. You're going to get demerits for that.
Wow.
I am not interested in you dragging in black teenagers for selling a little bit of marijuana. I don't care who's getting high. And I said, I don't care if they're doing small things. You are not to focus on that. That is not what we're about, because that destroys trust. When you throw people on the ground and slap handcuffs on them for, you know, selling a couple of hand-rolled cigarettes like Mr. Garner,
right,
that just totally destroys trust in the police.
Well, how do you promote the officers then that are in your 50 officers in your group? How are they promoted?
They have to demonstrate the relationships they've created with the community. And these are cops who every single day they go into that housing project and they figure out how to serve that population. They have bought 800 pairs of bifocals for the elders who couldn't afford them. They have brought in medical doctors with medical equipment in wagons to test for hypertension and diabetes. They have bought computers for the kids in school. You can't even list all the services they do. They are building trust through service. Trust through service. And by doing that, they have completely won over these populations. These are hardcore inner city public housing populations who revere these cops because these cops have bent over backwards to serve them. And by serving them, they're helping them to solve problems. And by helping them to solve problems, they're solving crime.
So crime's gone down. Crime's gone down in those neighborhoods?
Crime has plummeted. A 66% reduction in property crimes, a 90% reduction in physical crimes. I'll tell you the stat that bowled me. I had to sit down when I heard this one. There has not been a murder in Nickerson Gardens for 3 years. We used to have a body count weekly in Nickerson Gardens.
Wow.
And for there to be a three-year period with no murders, that's like saying in a brothel there were no sex acts for 3 years.
And anecdotally, you must converse with these officers. Is this a positive experience for them? Are they begrudgingly doing this? Or are they like, oh my God, this is, I love going to work. I love helping.
Well, in the beginning, it was definitely begrudging.
Right.
It's like, what the hell do these people have me doing? They're ruining my job. And then when they started seeing the public turn around and support them and speak to them and welcome them, introduce them to their kids, I mean, these cops have gotten standing ovations from public housing populations. It's just stunning. I cannot tell you what a turnaround it has been. And so they can't argue with those numbers. They may not like me. They may not like this. One man called it, one gang officer who doesn't like this model, he called it women's policing. And I said, well, guess what? Get your skirt on because you're getting ready to do it.
That's great. I have a question. I hear you talking, and I'm like, how much more does this cost?
If you talk about a gang murder, which has a lot of retaliation shootings that follow it, a gang murder can cost $1 million to $17 million for each murder, depending on how many retaliation shootings follow the original murder. If you look at the number of murders that have been reduced, the number of shootings that have been reduced, and you calculate the medical costs and the rehabilitation costs, the prosecution costs, the imprisoning costs, if you count all of that up, this program has saved hundreds of millions of dollars for the city of Los Angeles.
You know, this is so positive, and it's such a powerful story, and I've been reading about it for days. But I can imagine there are a lot of people I know who have read the grand jury transcripts of Michael Brown's death in Ferguson. They've seen the video of a 12-year-old, Tamir Rice, playing with a toy gun and being shot. They can hear Eric Garner in their head gasping, I can't breathe. And they hear you saying you're not at war anymore and they want to go to war. What do you say to their anger?
Oh, it's completely understandable. And to be honest, I don't begrudge it one bit. They should be angry. And they should be outraged. Now, anger and outrage feel good, and sometimes they're necessary outlets in response to an outrageous situation, which many of these shootings are. They're completely outrageous and completely unjustifiable. And if you are a relative of someone who's been murdered under these circumstances, there is nothing that can contain your rage. I understand that. I completely get that. And once you've expressed that rage, you have to ask yourself, okay, what's going to really prevent this from happening again? Well, it isn't going to be your rage. And it isn't going to be the marching, all of which I support. What's going to change it is changing how cops think. Hmm. So here's the deal. We either get in the boat and row with these cops, or we're going to be marching forever, and there are going to be unjustified shootings forever. The question is, what will change how cops behave, how they respond, and how they think? What will help them change? And that's what we have to focus on. And that's what I'm about the business of doing.
Connie Rice is a civil rights attorney in Los Angeles. To hear more of her story, check out her book, Power Concedes Nothing. And if you want to hear Charles Monroe Kane's full interview with her, visit our website at ttbook.org. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
Hello, I'm Karen Armstrong, author of Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence. And my dangerous idea is that we should love our enemies. This is a very famous saying of Jesus, of course, but it's often misunderstood. The word love in the ancient Near East was a political term, a legal term used in international treaties. Two kings who had previously been enemies would promise to love each other, which didn't mean they would fall into each other's arms and feel tender affection for one another or even like them, but that they would look out for one another and give each other practical help, that they would come to their aid whenever they were in trouble, even if this went against their short-term interests, and that they would live together in peace. I think now, in our dangerously polarized, globalized world, that unless now we learn to treat all peoples, whoever they are, as we would wish to be treated ourselves, we are not going to have a viable world for the next generation. And we need to treat our so-called enemies in that way, giving them practical help rather than guns and understanding their real situation. Why? Because very often the people who are our enemies have been injured by us. I'm thinking of the story of Jacob and Esau in the book of Genesis. This is a political allegory. Jacob represents Israel, we are told, and Esau represents the neighboring kingdom of Edom, with which Israel had trouble. But they were brothers. That is the point. The story shows they could not live without one another nor with one another easily. They were brothers, they were also twins. Very often, when we meditate on our enemy's faults and failings, we tend to become like him. We look into our enemy's eyes, we see ourselves. We British, for example, have helped to create the mess in the Middle East and did much to destabilize the social relations in the Indian subcontinent. And our histories are therefore intertwined. These enemies of ours are almost our own creation. And when we look into the eyes of our enemies, sometimes we see the results of our disdain. We learn to love our enemies by realizing that we ourselves are also at fault, that goodness rarely presides on one side only, that the doctrine of karma comes into play, that actions always have an effect. And it means that we have to have a certain self-knowledge and be prepared to come off our high horse. We have to remember that a lot of evil results from suffering and humiliation, of which we might be one of the causes.
Today's dangerous idea is from Karen Armstrong. She's the author of many best-selling books about comparative religion, and she'll join us next week to talk about her latest, Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence. And now it's time for On Our Minds. And because it's Christmas season, maybe we should ask WWJD, what would Jesus say or do about America's racial divide? So it seems like a good time to revisit an interview from our archives, Steve Paulson's conversation with Pastor Alex G., author of Jesus and the Hip-Hop Prophets, Spiritual Insights from Lauryn Hill and Tupac.
I started thinking about hip-hop artists today and people who speak out, who put their necks on the line to speak out against social ills, really put themselves at risk. And I started thinking, and this is not to bash organized churches or religion or Christianity or anything, but in terms of how society viewed Jesus, he was probably more similar to a Tupac than he was a Billy Graham. And I know I'm probably going to get all kinds of hate mail for saying that. Nothing against that organization or administration or that ministry, but I'm thinking in terms of how people really saw him. He was a threat to society. They didn't know where he was coming from. He didn't fit the religious mainstream profile, so they didn't know how to take him. But I like the gutsiness of the hip-hop artist. I love the way they get in your face and they address the real issues. They speak from their heart. They speak from their pain. And those are the kind of people Jesus hung out with. He didn't hang out with, you know, the folks who had it together, who were without spots or blemish. I mean, he hung out with the tax collectors. He hung out with the prostitutes. He hung out with the people that everyone else hated. Those were his buddies. He kicked it with them. And so it made me really start to think about hip-hop and its message. I really became intrigued, and actually I became a fan of it, and I had no intentions of that.
But I would think that when you first started talking about somehow incorporating hip-hop into your services, and I was just at your church last weekend, mm-hmm. and before the second service, there were these three young guys who got up and started rapping. And, you know, they were rapping and, you know, invoking Jesus in the process.
Right.
I would think that you must have gotten some flack from people in your congregation when you started to talk about this.
You know, it's one of those things. It was so strange that they thought either he's lost his marbles or maybe God's inspiring him to do that. But it was so far away from our normal mode of worship that I think people said, we have to give this a shot because, you know, Alex is going way out there. So there must be an inner voice telling him to try this.
Give me a couple of examples of hip-hop artists who you would refer to, who you think really have something important to say in a spiritual sense.
For example, in Tupac's song, Brenda's Got a Baby, I didn't know what to expect when I listened to this song. And I didn't grow up on hip-hop at all, so I had to do a lot of research. He starts off by saying, Brenda's got a baby. And I think, okay, he's going to talk about teenage pregnancy. Well, he tells a whole story about how her family was too busy reliving their childhood, left her in the care of her cousin who ended up molesting her, and she ended up having a baby. And he tells a story so that your view of Brenda at the end of the song is much different than what you thought at the beginning. And I think he conveyed a message that Christ always conveyed in Scripture. You never know what someone's been through, so you just can't take a look at the woman caught in the act or a leper or a tax collector and just say, mm-hmm, just as we figured. There's a story that brings dignity and humanity and worth to that person and to their story and to their struggle, and your paradigm is shifted towards Brenda. I think that that's the whole story of Scripture, never taking anyone at face value. Know that there's a story behind each person. It keeps you from being judgmental because you don't know what someone's felt. I think that has a strong spiritual message that you just can't look at someone and just say, ah, babies having babies. You don't know the story.
Brenda's barely got a brain, a damn shame. The girl can hardly spell her name.
That's not our problem, that's up to Brenda's family.
Well, let me show you how it affects our whole community. Now Brenda really.
What about Tupac's personal history? I mean, he was in prison for sexual assault. He was a drug dealer. He was killed in gang-related violence. He was murdered. What do you make of all that?
He sounds like he would have made a good disciple. I mean, Jesus, I mean, he ran with a pretty shady crew. Judas the Zealot was a nationalist. I mean, he'd be on the same level as a Black Panther, you know, under the scrutiny of the government and the FBI. But this is who he ran with. And I think too often we look for people who seem to fit the part rather than looking into their hearts. I think he saw something in their hearts. I wish I'd started listening to his music years ago. I wish there had been a mentor in his life. because he had a positive influence. I know there were some crazy things that he did, so I'm certainly not ignorant to those things. But I think if with his broken background, he was able to do the good that he did, could you imagine what he would have done had someone been in his corner? But if we continue to look at people with disdain because they've got tattoos or piercings and we think, well, God can't use them or they can't rally voters or they can't bring about social change, it might be that we're guilty of overlooking some of our potentially most prolific speakers and thinkers that are in our society today.
Gotta make a change. It's time for us as a people to start making some changes. Let's change the way we eat, let's change the way we live, and let's change the way we treat each other. You see, the old way wasn't working, so it's on us to do what we gotta do to survive. And still I see no changes. Can a brother get a little peace? It's war on the streets and a war in the Middle East. Instead of war on poverty, they got a war on drugs so the police can bother me. Coming back after all these years. Rat-a-tat-tat-tat-tat.
That's the way it is.
That's just the way it is.
That's the way it is.
I'm curious about what a prophet means to you. I mean, I guess when I think about biblical prophets, and I think about figures like Jeremiah and Elijah, are you putting Tupac in their company?
Oh, that's the big scary question. You know, when you take a look at the Old Testament prophets like Jeremiah or Ezekiel, they didn't appoint themselves as prophets. They were very reluctant. A prophet is one that speaks forth. It's not really foretelling. It's one that speaks boldly and speaks forth. It technically means an appropriate word for an appropriate season. And I think that the word that many of these artists are conveying is very appropriate for the season. So that's our thinking and our approach to them as cultural and social prophets. They're conveying messages that really is not being conveyed anyplace else, at least in circles that I travel. And again, I'm not here to bash church. I'm part of the church, so I'm not here as a critic of it. But you'd be hard-pressed to sit in a congregation and hear a pastor say, racism is sin, that there really is a glass ceiling, an old boys network, that some of the issues surrounding unemployment and underemployment and the things that are hitting the inner cities really goes deeper than people of color not wanting to work. You're hard-pressed to find religious leaders challenging the status quo and the American dream. These hip-hop artists don't think twice about it. And you cannot convince me that God is excited about this. But I feel if he can't get us to preach about it, he's got a ram in the bush. He's got a rapper who will get out and will bring it.
Illuminati, all through your body. The blows like a 12-gauge shot. Feel me? And God said he should send his one begotten son to lead the wild into the ways of the man. Follow me. Eat my flesh, flesh of my flesh. Come with me. Hail Mary, run quick, see. What do we have here now?
Alex G. is the pastor of Fountain of Life Church in Madison, Wisconsin, and the co-author with John Teeter of Jesus and the Hip-Hop Prophets. Spiritual insights from Lauryn Hill and Tupac. Steve Paulson talked with him.
Don't you know I love you?
To the best of our knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tungekar and Charles Monroe Kane produced today's show with help from Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, and Craig Ely. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Till next time.
PRI, Public Radio International.